12-step program things, and I was a
so it was a 42-step program.
Didn't answer that program tonight.
Accidentally discovered the rest of the
planet. And a quick prayer.
Okay.
Father, thank you for bringing us together here today. We got some new friends who come up. Thank you for bringing them here, getting them here safely. We ask that you would put your spirit on everybody in this room today so that they can see what truth is going to be put out today and so that they can comment on it as you give them a this is an open to question and comment teaching. We're not, I'm not a be all and end all of truth. And so I know that there's going to be things that are going to be raised in our heads. And Father, I ask that you would just make sure that it's nothing but your truth that comes out tonight. And that anything that's not true, you just help us to have it roll off our, out of our brains just like water from the bucket bath. And we thank you for the answer to that prayer, because I know it's going to happen in Yeshua's name. Amen. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Okay. What we're looking at tonight is at the answer to the ultimate question to the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. Okay? Now, I don't know if you all have ever read the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Okay. In this book... they created a computer that could answer any question. It would come up with the right answer. And sometimes it would take a little longer than others. Well, one day the people come up to the computer and they say, we'd like to know what is the answer to the ultimate question to life, the universe, and everything. And the computer said, well, I can answer that question for you, but it's going to take me a while to figure it all out. So come on back in 10 million years, and I'll tell you the answer. So 10 million years go by, and the descendants of those people that asked the question told their descendants, I asked this question, and he said, 10 million years, come on back, you can get the answer. You got to make sure that you get there to get the answer. So the 10 million years goes by, the descendants show up, and they say to the computer, our ancestors asked you, what is the meaning to life, the universe, and everything? And the computer said, I've got the answer for you, but I don't think you're going to like it. And they said, but we've been waiting 10 million years. We've been waiting 10 million years to get the ultimate answer to life, the universe, and everything, and we want you to give us the answer. And the computer said, all right. The answer to the ultimate question to life, the universe, and everything is 42. And the people said, 42? We've waited 10 million years and you give us an answer like 42? And the computer said, I told you you weren't going to like it. Hopefully y'all are going to like this a little better. Because what we're doing is we're looking at the 42 camps in the wilderness and how they relate to the 42 generations of Yeshua in Matthew chapter 1. And
It might take 10 million years.
Okay, this is the copyright notice. Okay, this is a copyrighted thing. Here's what the deal is. This copyright is under the common law. If you want to use this presentation or any part of it in an article or whatever, you're free to do so as long as you let us know. Give proper attribution, okay, that it came from here. That you provide us notice to where we can see it. And that you're not making money on it. Okay, free of charge. You may use it all you like. If these conditions are not met, prior permission must be received and may entail a large fee. Okay? You are responsible before the creator of the universe to act honorably. He is your judge, so my advice to you is to act honorably, to treat this thing accordingly, because he can cause a lot more pain to you than some shyster would. 42. What brought this idea to mind is I was teaching on Numbers 33. And in Numbers 33 is where Moshe goes through all of the camps that they stopped at. And he names them all. And because Yah told him, keep a diary of every place you've been. So I'm there and I get to Kadesh. And I notice that it's the 14th camp. And Kadesh is the place where the spies were sent. And they came back with an evil report. Okay, so I was thinking to myself, this is the 14th stop. There are 14 generation portions in Matthew chapter. Is there a possibility that there's a connection? So, is there a connection? Were there three sets of 14 camps in the wilderness that can be illustrated by the three sets of 14 generations? Okay, or do the 42 camps provide an illustration to the ancestry of Yeshua? Or both? Or something else entirely? Or nothing at all. So, 42. We're going to go take a look at it. And so here we are at the first, 42. We'll just use the meanings of the names and the meanings of the places, and we'll try to see if there's a connection. I'm going to try to connect the dots. If you see anything that brings something to your mind, the Spirit says something to you, get my attention so we can look at it. Okay? This is interactive. I want people to jump in. Let's face it. By the way, sometimes these connections might seem mystical. But the fact that you're holding in your hand the Word of God, the Creator of the universe, doesn't that seem a little mystical to you? That you have the Word of the Creator of the universe in your hot little hand. Mystical to me. So, here we go. As I share what I find, it will not be an exhaustive revelation. You may see a connection that I don't. So please get my attention and let me know what you see. I do not have a lock on all truth, so be bereaved. First stop was at Sukkot to retrieve Yosef's bones. They're going to take them to Shechem to bury them in Jacob's tomb, where Jacob's well is at. And the word Sukkot means booths or temporary shelters. Some say that this was the site of the treasure trove in Egypt, the treasure city in Egypt, where men came to receive the stuff, to buy goods from Egypt, because they had the only stores of food during that 7-year drought that was worldwide. It makes sense that Yosef, who had been the main businessman for Pharaoh, would be embalmed and buried there. This corresponds well with the first generation mentioned in Matthew chapter 1, Abraham, who dwelt in Sukkot all of his Hebrew life. From the time that he left Haran until the time that he died, he lived in Sukkot. He did not ever live in a town. He never lived in a building. He lived in a Sukkot. So the idea of the first generation being Abraham and the first stop being Sukkot lines up perfectly, right in Peshawar. Can't miss it. Hebrews 11 tells us that by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he would after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles, or Sukkot, with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him to the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is Elohim. So, we can see a correspondence here. Avi would not live in a permanent dwelling for as long as he lived. The second stop was Etam. Etam, which is at the head of the Wadi Watir, which, by the way, it leads through a sheer valley to the beach of Pi Hahiroth, which was the third stop, which is now modern Nuevo. Etam is possibly another form of Ketam, the Egyptian word meaning fortress, which makes sense, because Pi Hahiroth is the only place on the Egyptian littoral, on the Red Sea, that they could put an army, enemies could put an army ashore. Okay? You could get their landing craft out and wheel them right up there and drop it, like Marines do. If they were to do that, then they travel up the Wadi to attack, they would have to go past Etam, and so they've got big fortresses. At Pi Hahiroth, they also had this thing called Migdal, which is a tower. And it's a watchtower. And so the watchmen would see the ships coming, and they would run up that up from Pi Hahiroth up to Etam, and they would give the warning, and therefore they would be ready for any invader that was coming in. Okay, there are only two ways in or out of that particular gorge, if you will. And that is Pi Hahiroth or Etam. There was no way to get out of that gorge otherwise. The valley's walls were almost 90 degrees sheer. The maybe 85 degrees. Very hard to climb out of there, very rocky. This stop would correspond in Matthew chapter 1 to Yitzhak. Yitzhak, who was the entryway to the fulfillment of the promise that Yehovah had made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. Etam was the only way to Egypt's lands. The third stop, Pi-Hahiroth, is from the Hebrew word 6367. It's the strong word, 6367, mouth of the gorges. Looking at satellite images of the Wadi Watir, one can see at least a dozen tributary wadis emptying into it. So it is quite literally the mouth of the gorges. There are at least a dozen or more of them. And the smaller wadis all were dropping by waterfall into the thing. You could not escape that way. Inaccessible to the water and the body of Israel. So when they had Pharaoh on their back, they couldn't escape this place. They had to keep moving towards Pi-Hahiroth. And when they got to the beach, it was the only place on that Egyptian littoral. Littoral means where the sea meets the land. Okay. Only place on the Egyptian littoral where they could actually encamp 4 million people. Okay, this stuff corresponds to in Yeshua's genealogy to Yaakov, who had been named Israel by the angel of Yehovah, the post-resurrection appearance of Yeshua in the Tanakh, I believe. While they wrestled in the night before Yaakov returned to the land with his wives and children. Yaakov Israel, from whom came the 12 tribes, and with whom the 70 nations went into the world, Egypt, in figure, in Genesis chapter 46, now receives back from all of them, not just his children and theirs, but also from the 70 nations, that his son, Yeshua, had redeemed from the sins, and they were grafted into Israel. So he received all of his sons back, and he received also all of the nations of the earth that came out with Israel. Egyptian Exodus. So, not only did the 12 tribes and the 70 nations go into the land, they came out all at the same time, too. Okay, fourth stop was Mara. This is on the Saudi or the Midianite side of the Gulf of Aqaba, and it's about a 3-day journey inland. Mara means bitter, which refers to both the water that was there and the spirit that came over Israel when they discovered its nature and, by extension, their own. The water started out bitter, but was made sweet by Moshe's obedience to Yehovah. This connects very well with Yehuda, who was the fourth ancestor of Yeshua, named in Matthew chapter 1. Yehuda started out as a self-serving opportunist. Think about it for a minute. He's got all of his brothers. He and his brothers are out tending the sheep, and Yosef shows up. And he says, and Yehuda says, here comes this dream. Okay, let's get it. And so they put him in the pit, and Yehuda sees the Midianite traders coming, and he gets the idea to sell him into slavery. He then takes his coat of many colors, and he rips it up, and he dips it in lamb's blood. And he takes it back to his father, and he says, whose are these? Can you tell me whose these are? And his father sees that it's his son Joseph's coat of many colors, the only one like it in the whole world. And he starts, and he weeps, and he's broken. And that kind of broke Yehuda's heart. He left sometime very shortly thereafter and went off to live with Midianites in Bosra. Or the Edomites in Bosra. Okay, so this connects very well with him. Yehuda started out as a self-serving opportunist, but when Tamar in Bozrah set herself up to look like a prostitute, and Yehuda walks into town and he sees her, and he goes to hire her. And she said, well, what are you going to give me? And he said, well, I'll give you 2 sheep, and that should be that. She said, well, have you got them here? And he said, well, no, I haven't got them. Well, what will you give me as an earnest? That. Well, I'll give you my bracelets, I'll give you my walking staff, and what was the third?
A signet ring.
I'll give her a signet ring, that's it. And so he gave those to her, and he went in under her, and he came back out, and went home, and he sent the two sheep back by his friend. And his friend goes back to look for the harlot, and she's nowhere to be found. So he comes back with the sheep. I couldn't find her anywhere. Well, it's her fault that she didn't get the thing. Let her keep that stuff. Tamar is found 3 months later with a child. And so they come to Yehuda, and they say, your daughter-in-law is with child. Well, the reason that she did all of this in the first place is that he had promised her his third son. But he didn't want to lose that third son, because the first two sons that they married her both died. Right? So he didn't want to give his third son away. So she worked it out so that she became pregnant by him. Now, she goes before him, and he says, burn her, which, by the way, is Torah. That had not been delivered until 150 years later. So they knew Torah long before they actually had codified. So he changed completely because she came back with the walking stick and with the bracelets and with the signet ring, and she said to Judah, whose are these? Exactly what Judah said to Yaakov. And therefore, he knew that this was from Yehovah. Okay? Because Yehovah was hitting him with exactly what he did to his father. And from that point, Yehuda became a tzaddik. He realized how wicked he was because this Moabite woman was more righteous than he was. Okay? And he recognized it. He told her, you're more righteous than I am. Leave her alone. She had a baby, Pharaoh's. Which is the next generation. He was so much so changed at this point that when he went to Yosef in chapter 44 of Genesis, they'd already gone up once. They were told not to come back unless they brought their youngest brother Benjamin. So they go home with the stuff from Egypt, and they open up their bags and they find all of these. They found the gold cup. Right? This is just terrible. When they went back, Jacob said, go get us some more food. And so Judah said, we can't go back to get this thing unless Benjamin comes with us. He said, but I've lost my other son by my right hand. My right hand is Rachel. Benjamin, my son of my right hand. I can't let him go because if he dies or if he's held there, I'll go into my grave weeping, right? So Yehuda goes to Yosef and he says, I'm not. And he tells him, you know, my father will die if my brother Benjamin is left here. Please let him go back and keep me as the substitute for him. Okay? Showing forth a little bit of Yeshua and also showing that he had given up on his self-centeredness and was now centered on his father's well-being. He said, my father will go into the grave with a broken heart. So send him back and keep me there. That was when the very next words, by the way, are Yosef saying, get everybody out of here. And as soon as all the Egyptians were gone, he broke down weeping. And I believe he broke down weeping for joy at seeing the change in his brother. He saw his brother going from a really wicked man to being a tzaddik, a righteous man. And that's what changed him. One of the fifth stops. Fifth stop is at Elim, which I think was only a few more hours further, when they found 12 wells and 70 palm trees. Remember, they'd stopped at Marah. It was bitter water. They were not out of water when they got there, but they were running out. They knew that they were going to be needing water sometime soon. And so they saw all this water, and they couldn't use it. And they murmured against Moshe and against Yehovah. And Yehovah said, there's a tree over there, just dump that in the water, and it'll turn sweet. And sure enough, Yehovah turned the water sweet. They got to use the water. I think they went over the next hill, and here they see the 12 wells and the 70 palm trees. I mean, I don't think it took them a day to get there. So Elim is the plural of Hebrew 193, Ul, which means strength. This stop coincides with the ancestor of Yeshua, Perez, in Matthew chapter 1. Perez means breach. This could signify the breach between Yehudah, that is two Israel, and Ephraim, 10 Israel, 2 plus 10 equals 12 tribes, and the almost genetic disdain of Yehuda for Gentiles who want to come to the Torah. Okay? So, that's, by the way, the 70 nations. So you've got the 12 wells and the 70 nations, and the 70 palm trees, 12 tribes and 70 nations. Okay? That's what I think is our connection there. Of course, the 12 wells, that is Israel, are what sustains the 70 palm trees, the Goyim. But the meaning of Elim signifies the strength to be had in the two sticks of Ezekiel chapter 37, made one in Yehovah Yeshua's hands. Yes?
Paris means breach.
Yes.
Yeshua is referred to as the repairer of breach.
The repairer of breach. Very good. Thank you.
Bringing the 12 and the 70 back together, or the 10 and the 2, however you want to.
Exactly. Love that. That's very good. Yeshua is the repairer of the breach. Excellent. The sixth stop is by the Yam Suf. That's literally what it means. By the, whatever it is, there's by the Yam Suf. There's no name really given for it. Nothing is said of this stop in Exodus 15 or 16, and it is only mentioned in Numbers 33 without any specifics. Could it be because six is the number of men in Scripture? Or could it be that they were preparing for something else? Ancestor of Yeshua here is Hezron. His name means courtyard, as an enclosed place, like behind a fence or a wall. Perhaps this camp was in an enclosed valley, and it was surrounded by hills. This is the first stop that was not mentioned in the narrative, but was recorded by Moshe at the command of Yehovah and reported in Numbers 33. Perhaps this was where they prepared for the seventh stop. The seventh stop, which is really interesting to me, because this is the place where Yehovah trained Israel in, yes, Shabbat. Seventh stop, Shabbat. It's really interesting. Israel had been in hard bondage, worked all day, 7 days a week, for at least 100 years. It might have been only 110, 120, but it was at least 100 years. They had forgotten which day was the Shabbat, because they worked 7 days a week, 365 days a year. In Matthew 1, the seventh ancestor of Yeshua is Ram. This I got from Ruth chapter 4, the genealogy there. His name is, in Hebrew is Ram, not Aram, like it says in Matthew chapter 1. Ram means high and lofty, which is a good description of the seventh-day Shabbat that the nation was being trained in the wilderness of Sin. That, by the way, is the word Sin, not sin. This is not transgression of the Torah. Sin, by the way, is the name of the moon god of the Arab. Okay? It also happens to be the outskirts of the mountains in which Sinai is found. They stayed in the wilderness of Sin for at least a week, maybe probably two, where they got basic Shabbat training. Training via the manna. And that's, by the way, another PowerPoint teaching. The chapter 16 is, there are at least five or six different ways that Yehovah lays out 6 days' work, seventh day rest. 6 days' work, seventh day rest. The quail coming at the beginning of the first day, at the evening of the first day, and then the manna coming in the morning of the first day. And it's like that for 6 days in a row. On the sixth day, they get twice as much, setting aside that sixth, that seventh day as well. Because it's not only we get twice as much on the sixth day, we get none on the seventh. Not only does the stuff that is left over on the first 5 days go bad, and the stuff that's left over on the sixth day not, so that they can use it on the seventh. And then the stuff starts again on the eighth day, on the first day of the week. It starts coming again. And so it's laid, set aside at least four or five different times. Go ahead.
That's true about the manna, but what about the quail? I don't believe the quail.
Quail didn't come every day. It came that one time, the set apart that teaching, I believe. Go ahead.
Is there any connection between Sin and Allah?
Sin
and Allah?
Him, I didn't look. I don't know. I would expect that there is a connection, but this is in Midian, in And Allah, I don't believe, is a Midianite God. No. That was an Edomite God.
Well, Allah is an Ammonite God.
Ammonite.
Yeah. And it's a goddess, by the way. So yeah. It's a girl, it's a hermaphrodite. Not kidding.
Yeah. But you're right, Allah was the moon god. And
well, I was just thinking from the perspective of the end time, if there's manna held up for us, it seems like they're our number one enemy.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah. I agree with you. But I don't know. I would assume that there's a connection, but I didn't look into it. And I thought of that when I was going through here, too. And I don't know why I didn't do that. I probably should have. Anyway, that's the seventh stop. The eighth stop is Dofka. Dofka means a noun. Dofka is actually a subject, a noun. From the root, Hebrew 1849, dafak, which means to knock. They were knocking at the revelation of Yehovah's word. It's not but another stop or two, and they're going to be getting Torah. The ancestor of Yeshua that corresponds to Dofka is Aminadab, which means people offering freely. After they gained the understanding that Yehovah would provide all their needs, water, nutrition, even fresh flesh food if they wanted it, they offered themselves freely to him, at least until they ran out of water, which comes in the next stop, refuge. Oh, I'm sorry, this is a loosh. This one is a loosh. There is no Hebrew. This is why I missed it. There is no Hebrew definition and no indication of any important things happening here, so Alush is not mentioned in the Exodus. The ancestor of Yeshua in Matthew chapter 1 is Nachshon. He was the Yehudi elder of the Exodus who was succeeded by Caleb, that Kenite dog of a Gentile. That's why they named him Caleb. 9 is the number that signifies confusion by diminishing from the word Yehovah. 10 minus 1 equals 9. Nachshon's name means enchanter and is derived from the root nachash, which variously is hiss, to make a noise like that of magic, to whisper a magic spell, or a snake. Okay? The brazen nachash was a source of evil. The fiery nachash was a source of evil. The brazen nachash is what they could look at to be relieved from the pain and death of the fire serpents. Nachshon voted with the 10 tourists in Kadesh. And we'll see that in a little bit. Stop number 10 was at Rephidim, where they had no water. But after they kvetched about it enough, they got some. Yehovah had Moshe tap the rock at Rephidim, and the water gushed out from the rock. In Matthew chapter 1, the corresponding ancestor is Salmon, whose name means garment or investiture. This is not a game fish. Salmon. Okay? This is not fish that's swimming in the water. Is okay. Anyway, investiture is the act of conferring title or office on a person, clothing him with authority. When Moshe struck the rock and the water gushed forth, Yehovah clothed him with authority like never before. The 11th stop is the wilderness of Sinai. This is where Israel received the Ten Commandments and the rest of the covenant. This is where they sent elders into the very throne room of Yehovah. You know, they went up onto that mountain, and 75 of them, 76 of them altogether. Aharon, his four sons, Moshe, and 70 elders of Israel went up into the mountain, and they sat and ate with Yehovah, face to face in his throne room. They walked up the mountain and into spiritual space, and while they were there, they didn't age, they didn't hunger, but they got hungry. I mean, when you're in the presence of Yehovah, you are in spiritual space. Okay? Like it or not, that's what you're like. That's why Moshe was able to go up there for 40 days, 40 nights, and not eat, and not be hungry, and not age. 40 days while he was up there, because he was outside of time and space when he was in the presence of Yehovah. Okay. This is where Israel received the Ten Commandments, and the rest of the fellow, okay, sorry. And they built the Mishkan, by the way, while they were there. And this is also where they offered to the Egyptian idols the golden calf. So that's where we're at in this particular place. The ancestor of Yeshua that corresponds is Boaz, the husband of Ruth, and Tanakh's best illustration of kinsman redeemer. A fitting person to match to the giving of the Torah as he was a tzaddik, and he lived out that Torah all of his life. As far as we know, nothing bad is ever said about Boaz, just like nothing bad is ever said about Yosef, just like nothing bad is ever said about Dan. That they lived righteous lives from as early as we had it. The 12th star is Kibroth Hata'aba, where Israel murmured about their need for flesh food. Kibroth Hata'aba means graves of longing or lusting. The patriarch that corresponds to this is Obed, whose name means servant. It comes from Abad, the Hebrew word Abad. The reason for the graves of lust is that the Israelites served themselves on the quail. Remember, Yahweh sent the quail, and it was waist high, and it was all over the camp. Okay? And the people went out and they grabbed this stuff and they started eating it without offering it to Yahweh, without leading it. They might have already still been cooing. Who knows? But I think that they died with the sinews in their teeth and the blood running down their chins. Lots, like 30-some thousand people died in that particular place. Okay. The 13th stop is Chatzarot, which means fencer yard. Now, I don't know if there's any actual Hebrew linguists in here. This is an interesting thing, and I've got to ask the question. There was a Chatzarot where Miriam and Aharon murmured against Moshe because of his Ethiopian wife. And Miriam was afflicted with Tzaharat. Now, Chatzarot and Tzaharat sound similar to me. Is there any connection between those two words?
Well, one's a Tzad and the other one's a Chet.
Well, yeah, I understand. But we got the Tzadi, we got the Chatzarot and the Tzaharat. That's why I'm asking. Okay? If we remove that head, are those words similar? That's what I'm asking. Is there a connection between the two? I don't know. But it sounds similar. Okay? Anyway. The KJV, by the way, translates Sahara as leprosy. But in reality, it's probably more like an all-over-the-body case of psoriasis, okay? Which is not common. Okay. She was cleansed of the Tzaharat as soon as Moshe interceded for her. He went to Yehovah immediately, and Yehovah immediately cleansed her. However, she still had to be 7 days outside the camp. And so what the Israelites learned here was that even their leadership had to follow the Torah. She was guilty of Lashon Hara. That's why she got the leprosy. Okay? She brought this evil report to Aharon about her brother Moshe. Okay? Yehovah hit him hard with that. Even the leadership had to abide by Torah. This had to be new to these people. Because they've been living in Egypt for those 100 years. And the Egyptians could do whatever they wanted as far as they were concerned. Okay? By the way, same thing happens in America. The authorities can do whatever they please. Okay? Say, they're above the law. Israel could not enter the land with an unclean leader, so the whole camp had to stay in camp at Chatzarot for a week until Miriam was able to come back in the camp. Then they could leave. So, remember that, the corresponding ancestor is Yishai, whose name means to be or to stand out. So this particular camp probably stood out to them because they learned that even the leadership has to follow the Torah. It wasn't just for the people, it was for everyone. That had to stand out in their minds. Stop number 14 is Ritma. In Numbers chapter 33, it's called Ritma. This is actually Kadesh Barnea. Okay? It's called Kadesh Barnea in the narrative as we're going through in the Numbers. And this is where they sent out the 12 spies. These 10 of these spies decided that they wanted to be tourists, and they brought home some really impressive souvenirs. But two of the men decided that they were going to be tzaddik. They were going to obey Yehovah. Okay? Mighty men of God. Ritma means to yoke to a pole. I think they call this Ritma here to intimate that they were there for a long, long time. Some of the rabbis say that they actually were there for more than half of their time of the Windsor Venture. And I can see that, judging by the name, of course. Rhythmia, Johnny Gould Pole. The 19 plus years. The ancestor corresponding is the V. Now, he was definitely was the one king who yoked the two houses of Israel together. Okay? In this way, he was a wonderful type of Mashiach and David. Also, the gematria of David's name is 14. Dalet plus Bob plus Dalet equals Yud Dalet. All right, I'm sorry. Yud Dalet. 14. Anyway, this was the zenith of Israel's righteousness as a nation. David's reign was the absolute pinnacle of their righteousness. Stop 28 will match Israel's nadir, national righteousness. Local. 15th stop is Rimon Peretz. The name means pomegranate breach, and it only appears in this chapter. So nothing of any importance has occurred there either. But the name of Yeshua's ancestor, which corresponds, is Shlomo, who began the rift between the two houses and Yaakov, in two ways. Number one, he breached Torah by multiplying pagan wives and worshiping their Elohim, not to mention multiplying horses and chariots. They were forbidden to do. And number two, by treating the men of the northern tribes differently from the men of the southern tribes. In 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 3b and 4, it says, "And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake to Rehoboam, saying, Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we shall serve him." Okay? All you got to do is lighten the load a little bit. Treat us a little bit more fairly than your father. Rehoboam made the wrong decision, of course, by not heeding the counsel of his father's chief advisors, who told him, yes, do this, and you're going to have these people behind you. If you don't, we're going to have a rift. But the seeds of secession, the breach in the United Kingdom, was started by Shlomo.
So, what do you mean by that? The seeds of secession were...
The seeds of secession were begun in Shlomo's reign, because he started treating Israel, the ten tribes, differently than Judah. And they didn't miss it. All they asked was to have their load lightened a little bit. And if they had done that, then they would have followed Rehoboam and his camp. Instead, Rehoboam said, "Well, I'm going to make my father, that was a twig. I'm going to get you with an iron." You think that he was dead? Wait till you find out what I did. And Jeroboam said, "Right here, buddy. I'm going getting out of here, and we're going to be at war." And then Rehoboam starts to put his army together, and Yehovah sends a prophet and tells him, "Don't you dare. This is from me. Don't you dare." And Rehoboam really was nothing as king. He was nothing. Okay, I'm sorry. 16th stop is Libna. Libna also is not mentioned in the narrative. Yeshua's ancestor corresponding to the 16th camp is Rehoboam. His name means a people has enlarged. His mother, Naamah, was a Ammonites. Libna means whiteness or transparency. After the split that occurred in his reign, there was nothing that Rehoboam did that was of any importance. But one thing that happened in his reign that had any importance whatever wasn't as a result of anything that he did. It was because of what his father did. That split was due to Shlomo's actions. It was as if Rehoboam had never been transparent. You see right there? What a name. Libna, transparency. 17th stop. 17th stop was at Rissa. Strong's on Rissa. Use these three words. 44-46, Rissa is a ruin, as dripping to pieces. It's a place in the desert. 74-50, Rassas, means to come in mute. Also used as the nominative of 74-47, to moisten. And then 74-47 is Rassis, properly dripping to pieces. In other words, a ruin. also a duty. Webster's 1828 dictionary defines common use as to reduce to fine powder. So Rissa was a ruin that was literally falling apart before their eyes, eroding away so quickly that it was as if it was flowing like water. The place must have been constructed of mud or an adobe-like material that couldn't hold up to the constant pounding of the wind and whatever the wind carried. And so it was breaking up and just ripping apart right before their eyes.
Sorry. They had no other occurrences?
I said that it was not mentioned in the narrative.
Okay. Because it shows up right.
Right. I'm just saying it wasn't in the ongoing narrative.
Okay.
Not
that I'm checking.
Well, it's okay. You're allowed to. Please do. The 17th stop in Yeshua's genealogy, naming Yeshua's genealogy, is Abiyam, or Abijam, who had no children, and when he died, after only 3 years on the throne, his brother Asa ascended the throne. His name means the sea is my father. I think that this was what was being comminuted, okay, reduced to powder, was the reign of less than righteous kings, beginning with Shlomo in the latter years of his reign. What were also being comminuted was the righteousness of the people, with some notable exceptions, as we'll see a little bit later, and Abiyam's physical seed line. It's not going to go any further. The 18th stop, the encampment was at Kehelatah, which means a place of congregation or gathering. It's from the root Kahal. Nothing of import happened here either. The messianic ancestor who corresponds to this is Asa. To this point, only David had been consistently a king who was at the Jehovah's heart, with a few minor exceptions, like Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba, and Absalom. He was a guy. What are you going to do? But he was happy. He wanted Yehovah's heart to be his. And that's what Yehovah said. He's a man after my own heart. Okay. 18th stop. Asa and his son, Jehoshaphat, were personally righteous, though the people were growing ever more distant from Yehovah. Asa begins a run of righteous kings in Yehudah, where the worship of Yehovah was the general order of the day, despite the ever-enlarging minority who went after other elders. The 19th stop was Mount Shafer. The root, Shafar, means to glisten or beautiful. For the fifth time running, nothing of major import happens here, but the messianic ancestor is Jehoshaphat, whose name means Jehovah judges. While Jehoshaphat cemented a political relationship with Ahab and Jezebel by marrying his heir, Jeroboam, to a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, Athaliah, his own character and commitment to Jehovah cannot be understated. He was a righteous king. He did some dumb things, but he was a righteous king. One of the worst things he did was to go out and fight with Ahab. He's shown in comparison to his contemporaries, actually demanding a prophet of Yehovah, to found. He showed in comparison to his contemporaries actually demanding a prophet of Yehovah be found to prophesy of the battle that he and Ahab were about to go out and fight. As the people of Israel and Yehuda became less set apart to Yehovah, even the righteous king started to think that Yehovah was less interested in their political lives than in their personal lives, somehow forgetting that they are interrelated. What you believe should rule every aspect of your life, even your politics. Athaliah's name means Yehovah compresses or constrains. Well, Yehovah compresses the genealogy of Yeshua by three generations. I believe due to the wickedness of Athaliah and her son. We'll see that in just a second. The missing three generations fit Exodus chapter 20, even though there were two righteous kings among them, Joash and Amaziah. You shall not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, Yehovah Elohecha, am jealous Elohim, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and the fourth generation of them that hate me. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 5. I believe this was done to thin the DNA of Jezebel out of the Davidic line. 20th stop was at Charada, which is feminine for the root charad, meaning trembling, fearful. Nothing important happened here either. The corresponding ancestor of Yeshua is Yehoram, whose name means Yehovah raises. What Yehuda was raising was the awareness that Athaliah was a wicked influence on her husband, Jeroboam, king of Yehuda, and the fear and trembling that ought to be known in Yehuda. The 21st stop was at Mechela, which, like Kehelatah, means comes from the root Kehal, meaning assembly. Nothing important occurred here either, but 7 stops in a row. The ancestor corresponding to this stop is Uzziyahu, Uzziah, strength of Yehovah, or Azariyahu, which is Yehovah has helped. Both names are applied to the same king, Uzziah and Azariah, same God. Notice that 3 generations of kings were not mentioned in Yeshua's genealogy. Ahaziah, Athaliah the usurper, who is the queen mother that killed all of her grandsons except Joash, Jehoash, and Amaziah. I assume that these were left out due to their tainted DNA. The 4th generation may have been sufficiently purged of the Jezebel DNA to be included again. I look at this and I say to myself, in Noah's day, Noah was said to be perfect in his generation. Perfect in his generations to me means that he had unspotted genetics. Okay? In his generations, from the word that also means genetics. Okay? So he was clean. His bloodline was clean. And his sons were all clean. Somehow, the Nephilim DNA got through, and I think it was by one of Noah's daughters. Not sure, but it makes sense.
Talmud teaches that he lost his first wife and remarried Naima. So as a result, he brought the sin right along with him on the boat, and he brought Naima.
Okay, so the 3 sons were by his first wife.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but then that ties into the sin of Ham and sleeping with his father's wife.
Yeah.
Right. The whole cursed line of
exactly
sexual demons that begins there in the scripture.
Very good. Thank you. I did not
because of genealogy, you're cursed 3rd and 4th generation. So
right.
It wasn't Ham who was cursed, it was his son.
Who was most likely the product of that incestuous relationship.
Very good. Very good. Thank you. Okay, the 21st stop. I think that the fear and trembling of Haradah was not wasted on Azariyahu, Uzziah, and his descendants, whose father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had all lost a lot of blessing due to Yehoram's and Amaziah's idolatrous lifestyles, and which were passed down. I mean, Yehoram is the son of Rehoboam. I'm sorry, the son of Yehoash. Yehoshaphat. And it was a marriage of political convenience to try to bring Israel back together in a way that Yehovah didn't want it done. Again, anytime we step out and do things for Yehovah, it's always necessary. Always. The 22nd stop was Tahat, meaning below. No important happenings here either. Matthew 1's corresponding ancestor is Yehotam, whose name means Yehovah is complete or perfect. Yehotam. Okay. In his own life, Yehotam was a righteous king who was in Mashiach, in whom his kahal is Tamim. By the names below him in Mashiach's genealogy begin to become more wicked, with a couple of outstanding exceptions. And I mean only a couple. Stop 23 is at Terach, meaning wild goat, wanderer, or wayward. Again, nothing of any importance. I'm beginning to think that all the action was at just 2 or 3 different places. Everything that we read in the Numbers about their moving through the wilderness, the only things that happened were in Kadesh, in a couple of places that we're going to see. Not much else happened anywhere else, so they were pretty much bored as they were moving. The life in the wilderness was a lot like Navy crews in the war zone. You who have been in the Navy understand long periods of boredom punctuated by short, brief moments of abject terror. Okay? That's very much like what it is in a war zone on a Navy ship. The son of, and probably is in the field too, by the Marines, probably is also for you Air Force guys who always are so far away from the actual action.
Sometimes.
Sorry, we got Air Force guys here. I have one now. Anyway, the son of David, ancestor of Yeshua, corresponding to this stop is Ahaz. Ahaz is an unrighteous king in Jerusalem. I'm going to read a little bit about him here from 2 Kings chapter 16. Starting in verse 2. 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and did not that which was right in the sight of Yehovah his Elohim, like David his father did. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Yea, he made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the heathen, whom Yehovah cast out from before the children of Israel. I'm going to stop right there at the end of verse 3. This is passing your children through the fire to Moab, and it is the ancestor of abortion. Children were taken from their mother's womb and immediately given to Moab. And the Tophet caves, the Moloch worship was done on December 25th, okay, and they were offered in the Tophet caves, the babies. And then those that were not born yet were held over until Ishtar. And they were sacrificed on the same altar. So, you know, it was a very, very wicked thing. Yehovah did not want us to do that. Here's the king of Yehuda. Okay, verse 4. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. If you read the entire chapter of 2 Kings chapter 16, you will see that there may not have been a more wicked king ever in Yehuda. So the connection is obvious between the wild goat campsite and perhaps the most wicked son of David to occupy the throne. 24th stop was called Midka, which means sweetness, not to be confused with old paper. This is the 10th straight stop where nothing of any importance happened. Kiskiyahu, that's Hezekiah, the ancestor of Yeshua, corresponds here as one of the great righteous kings of Yehuda. He pulled down the high places and the groves in Yehuda and instigated a top-down revival. The sweetness was seen in the way that Hezekiah tore down the pagan altars and the high places in Yehuda. But top-down action seldom works for the benefit of the whole people. Next stop is Hashmonah. Stop number 25. The word means firm or capacious in resources. And for the 11th straight stop, nothing happened there. Manasseh, is the ancestor of Mashiach, who corresponds to this stop. Menashe was wicked for most of his reign, which was the longest in Yehuda's history, 55 years. He encouraged a rapid declension into idolatry for the people, and he went after the strange Elohim himself. He set up an image, an obelisk, in the groves, in the temple itself, rather of the groves, in the temple itself. That's in 2 Kings chapter 21. And we're going to start reading in verse 7 here. And he set a graven image of the grove that he had made in the house, of which Yehovah had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, will I put my name forever. So this is the temple itself. And he's put a graven image in the temple. Verses 8-9. Neither will I make the feet of Israel move any more out of the land which I gave their fathers, only if they will observe to do according to all that I have commanded them, and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. But they hearkened not, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than did all the nations whom Yehovah destroyed before the children of Israel. They were even more wicked than the Canaanites that they chased out under Manasseh's reign. Now that's in the first part of Manasseh's reign, probably for the first 4 years or so. But Manasseh also had a personal revival near the end of his life, starting in verse 9 of the same chapter. And this is going to be kind of lengthy. So Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err, and to do worse than the heathen whom Yehovah had destroyed before the children of Israel. And Yehovah spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. Wherefore, Yehovah brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh from the among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in affliction, he besought Jehovah his Elohim and humbled himself greatly before the Elohim of his fathers. Now, notice, please, that he's dragged through the thorns, he's bound in fetters, he's carried to Babylon, and he's in affliction. All of this has to do with the affliction of being taken into captivity. Okay, and it prayed unto him, and he was entreated of him, and heard his supplication, and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that Jehovah, he was Elohim. Now after this, he built a wall without the city of David, on the west side of Gihon, in the valley, even to the entering of the fish gate, and comes to Baal Ophel, and raised it up a very great height, and put captains of war in all the fenced cities of Judah. And he took away the strange Elohim, and the idol out of the house of Jehovah, and all the altars that he had built in the mount of the house of Jehovah and in Jerusalem, and cast them out of the city. And he repaired the altars of Jehovah, and he sacrificed thereon peace offerings and thank offerings, and commanded Yehuda to serve Jehovah Elohim of Israel. And they did. Nevertheless, the people did sacrifice still in the high places, yet unto Jehovah their Elohim only. Okay, so they were using the high places offer to Jehovah, which was strictly forbidden in the Torah. The people had not made him full repentance. Manasseh did. Manasseh's revival was not enough to get him buried among his fathers. Actually, I think it probably was, but he had himself buried in his own property. I think that his revival was enough. Jehovah would have allowed him to be buried among his fathers. But he was so humbled by his transportation into Babylon. I think he was thoroughly humbled by Jehovah and thought himself unworthy to be buried among his fathers. So in the end, Menashe became firm in his trust in and service to Jehovah. Remember that the stop is Hashmonah, firm or capacious in resources. Menashe's last end was exactly that. He was firm and capacious in resources towards Jehovah. The next stop is number 26, Moserot. Wherefore the 12th straight can nothing of import happen. Moserot means corrections. The Messiah's ancestor corresponding here is Ammon. Ammon was as wicked as his father had been at the beginning of his reign, until his uncle who brought him up. Ammon means brought up or raised up, and or nurtured rather. And he had been raised to be a pagan, and he carried that out throughout his life. Ammon was so wicked that Jehovah only let him reign for 2 years. Judging by his mother's and maternal grandfather's names, which I forgot to look up, he was firmly rooted in his wickedness, so much so that no one could trust him, and he was killed by a conspiracy of his friends and servants in his own house. Stop number 27 was Bene Yakan, which means sons of twisting or torturous sons. This 13th eventless camp corresponds to Yeshua's umpteenth grandfather. Didn't bother counting how far back it was. Yoshiyahu, who began to reign when he was 8 years old. His advisor was Hilkiyahu, the Kohen HaGadol. In the 18th year of his reign, he ordered a general cleanup of the temple. During that cleanup, this included, by the way, losing the images and the groves of his great grandpappy, grandpappy. Who he had set up and was and with which his father had gone after with reckless abandon. In the cleanup process, what to their wondering eyes should appear but a Torah scroll? No one had seen it since at least Menashe's time, at least 20 years. 2 Kings 22, verse 8, and then verses 10 through 20. I'm going to read it all, so get prepared. And Hilkiah the high priest said unto Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of Jehovah. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. And Shaphan the scribe showed to the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest had delivered me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And it came to pass when the king had heard the words of the book of the law, that he rent his clothes. And the king commanded Hilkiah the priest, and Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Achbor, the son of Micaiah, and Shaphan the scribe, and Asahiah, a servant of the king's, saying, Go ye, inquire of Jehovah for me and for the people and for all of Judah, concerning the words of this book that is found. For great is the wrath of Jehovah that is kindled against us, because our fathers have not hearkened unto the words of this book, to do according unto all that which is written concerning us. So Hilkiah the priest, and Ahikam, and Achbor, and Shaphan, and Asahiah, went to Huldah the prophetess, the wife of Shaphan, the son of Tikva, the son of Harhas, keeper of the wardrobe. Now she, that is Huldah, dwelt in Jerusalem in the college, and they communed with her. Now this is the only prophetess that's spoken of in the prophets. There are other prophetesses, but they're talked about in the narratives. And she said unto them, Thus saith Jehovah, Elohim of Israel, Tell the man that sent you to me, Thus saith Jehovah, Behold, I will bring evil upon this place, and upon the inhabitants thereof, even all the words of the book, which the king of Yehuda hath read. Because they have forsaken me, and have burned incense unto other Elohim, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall be kindled against this place, and shall not be quenched. But to the king of Yehuda, which sent you to inquire of Jehovah, thus shall you say to him, Thus saith Jehovah, Elohim of Israel, As touching the words which thou hast heard, because thine heart was tender, and thou hast humbled thyself before Jehovah, when thou heardest what I spake against this place, and against the inhabitants thereof, that they should become a desolation and a curse, and hast rent thy clothes, and hast wept before me, I have also heard thee, saith Jehovah. Behold, therefore, I will gather thee unto thy fathers, and thou shalt be gathered into the grave, thy grave in peace, and thine eyes shall not see all the evil which I will bring upon this place. I think the connection between stop number 27, Yakan, twistings, and Yoshiyahu is made pretty plain. Yoshi was afraid that he would see the nation rent from its inheritance, and Jehovah assured him that his personal righteousness would hold off the final judgment and exile for as long as he occupied David's throne. I want to stop there for just a second. I mean, think about this. If by some strange chance Yehovah was to work it out that a man after his heart was elected president of the United States, this could happen to us. But the way it's going right now, it probably ain't going to happen. And we're going to see major judgment come down on us in the not too distant future. I mean, it's not like we haven't been getting it since at least the 80s. That I can think of, beginning with the earthquake, beginning of the World Series in San Francisco, and the Mississippi overflowing its banks, that 500-year levee being breached, and I don't know how many states were covered with water. I mean, it's just incredible stuff. And that was just a minor thing compared to what's been going on. It gets worse and worse and worse as we go. Because Jehovah is trying to get our attention so that we'll repent. And it's not those guys out there that need to worry about it. It's us guys even here that need to be doing the repentance. We're the guys that need to be humbling ourselves and getting before Jehovah and taking ownership of this nation's sins, like Daniel did in Daniel chapter 9. He took ownership of Israel's sins. And what happens? He gets great revelation from the Lord God on the coming of the Messiah and the coming of the interest of the Lord. Things that are going to happen in the end of the day. So, anyway, I think that we could, if we had a righteous man in the White House, could see a bookmark placed in our judgment. But I don't see it happening this time anymore. The 28th stop is for Hagigah, which means cave of self-inflicted cuts, where for the 14th stop in a row, nothing important happens. Sounds like a Tophet cave to me, self-inflicted cuts. The refusal of the kings of Yehuda to enforce Yehovah's Torah in their kingdom was the source of the self-inflicted cuts that got the nation carried off in battle. Moshiach's ancestor that matches this stop, this is the 28th stop, by the way, the second 14 ends here, is Koniahu, or Coniah, or Jeconiah, the king of whom it was prophesied in Jeremiah chapter 22 and verse 30, Thus saith Jehovah, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling any more in Yehudah. Because Jeconiah was written childless, none of his seed could flourish on the throne of David. That does not preclude them from sitting on the thrones of other nations. Okay? Which, by the way, they did in Parthia. Parthia was the rival to the Roman Empire at the time of Yeshua. Yeshua was born. All of those kings, the wise men that came from the east, came from Parthia. They were the descendants spiritually of Daniel. Daniel had put together gold, frankincense, myrrh, the stuff that he sent to the Messiah. He told them how to know when Messiah was coming, that there would be a star in the sky. They saw the star. Oh boy, let's take this stuff. And a huge caravan from Parthia, guarded by as many as 20,000 Parthian soldiers, came to Jerusalem. And it was not three wise men. It was a gazillion wise men, because they're carrying all this stuff out for Yeshua. Pretty amazing. The big caravan, at least 20,000 people, according to Stephen Collins' book on Parthia. And I have no reason to doubt it. I mean, it's a very plausible story. Why would all of Judah be in an uproar over this caravan of three kings? You know, maybe 10 or 15 people. Why would they be in an uproar? But they see Parthia and 20,000 Parthian soldiers coming. Now they got something to be worried about. Okay? And by the way, so does Rome.
Right.
Because Parthia and Rome were rivals until maybe 100 years before. And they were rivals again 50 or 60 years later. Okay, Parthia was the only empire that could rival Rome in power. As long as Parthia decided they would stand on their side of the Euphrates, Rome didn't mess with them. As soon as Rome came across the Euphrates to mess with Parthia, Parthia kicked their butts. It chased them right back across. Okay? They were at loggerheads quite a bit. So, that's the 28th side. Parthian Empire, by law, had to have a son of David sit on the throne. Didn't have to be one in the kingdom line, but it had to be a son of David. Could have been that line in Luke that's talking. Maybe those people were the kings of Parthia. Who knows? Okay? And there were many other sons of David. So anybody who could prove his lineage back to David would be eligible to be the king in Parthia. However, the fact that this verse is in Matthew's gospel record is what convinces me that this, the genealogy in Matthew, is Joseph's, not Miriam's line of descent. What would be the point of mentioning the curse on Jeconiah if it's Mary? Miriam, who is, it's her genealogy. She can't sit on the throne anyway. She's a woman. Only men can sit on the throne, unless they're usurpers, like Athaliah. Okay? So, that doesn't make any sense. Daughter of David is not eligible. This, by the way, was the nadir. The zenith is the height, and the nadir is the low point. Okay? This is the nadir of Israel's national righteousness, Jeconiah. It's at this point that they're carried off in the battle. Stop number 29 was Yotbatah, meaning pleasantness. Again, nothing important happens here. The ancestor of Yeshua corresponding here is Shealtiel, whose name means I have inquired of Jehovah. The connection is quite plain in this instance because all of the other sons, all the sons of Yoshiyahu, were all wicked men. Shealtiel, by the way, and all three of them were governors in Judah under Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Okay, Jeconiah was the king who was carried off, and then his two brothers were made governors. And that was Zedekiah and who was the other? I don't know who the other one was. Jehoiakim. So, all wicked men. Shealtiel must have been a breath of fresh air. Remember, I have inquired of Elohim. While he was not a king in Babylon, the people of Yehuda still looked to him for leadership because he was the heir to David. The leadership in Babylon was likely crucial his leadership in Babylon, rather, was likely crucial to what Yehuda and Israel, their companions, experienced there. Stop number 30 is at Hebronah, which Wikipedia, it's got to be true, says was the beginning of the descent and the pass through from the high Araba, the mountains just above the Red Sea, to Etzion Geber on the Gulf of Aqaba. Hebronah means passage, and its root is Avar, to cross over. In this case, they're crossing over from the highlands to the valley. This is the 16th uneventful stop in succession, and Israel must have been getting bored. They don't have to wait much longer for some action. The Messiah's patriarch that corresponds here is Zerubbabel, who led Israel, or I'm sorry, Yehuda, back across the Euphrates, okay, on their return trip to Haaretz. Zerubbabel is a compound word meaning of Zerab, meaning to flow away like hot wax. That's what it says in Strong's. And Babel, meaning confusion. After Ritma, that is Kadesh, this was the furthest from Israel that Israel got. Furthest from the land that Israel got. They're as far away as they can possibly be here in Etzion Geber. I'm sorry, here in Hebron. They were heading towards Etzion Geber, which is on the north shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. And from this point onward, from Hebronah onward, they're spiritually headed up to the land, flowing like wax from a flame, the flame being confusion of Babylon. We were flowing away from the confusion of battle and towards the promised rest. Promised rest is the metaphor there, is Yeshua HaMashiach. He is our promised rest, as it says in Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 9 through 11. There remaineth therefore rest to the people of Elohim, for he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as Elohim did from his. Let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. They would labor through a series of successful battles with Canaanite tribes, while not suffering even a scratch in them. Stop number 31 was at Etzion Geber, which is another compound word, Etzion meaning spine, and Geber meaning a valiant warrior. So it means the backbone of a valiant warrior. This is from Geber, by the way, is the same root as goes into the word Gabriel, angel of Jehovah. And his name means, my valiant warrior is Elohim. The ancestor of Yeshua that corresponds here is Abihud, or Abihud. Abihud's name means, my father is renowned, or an imposing figure or person. That's kind of like the quote. Chuck Norris was born on May 6, 1945. Germany surrendered on May 7, 1945. Need I say more? I mean, if Chuck Norris is your father, you are going to win every schoolyard debate because your father really, truly can kick the other guy's Abihud butt. Okay? Well, in this case, Abihud, Yehovah, is Abihud's father. Even Chuck Norris can't beat him. Number 32 was at the wilderness of Zin, which is Kadesh, where Miriam died. They stayed here for just enough time to mourn Miriam. Moshe called it Ritma earlier, stop number 14. I think because they were there for such a long time, as I said before. The word literally means yoked to a pole, Ritma. Now they're in Kadesh. Here, it is called by its proper name because they were on their last leg of their journey and had been set apart unto Yehovah, and the place was set apart by the death and the subsequent sitting Shiva for Miriam. Kadesh is the same word as Kadosh with a little bit different vowel in it. Okay? It means set apart. The ancestor corresponding here is Eliakim. Elohim raises up. Not Elohim rises up, but raises up. That Yehovah had set Israel apart, exalted us, and we were on our spiritual ascent to our inheritance. The 33rd stop was at Mount Hor, where Aharon died and passed his mantle to his son Eleazar. Israel stayed here for another time of sitting Shiva. the custom of sitting Shiva is that the family in mourning is visited by extended family and friends for a Shavua, a week of mourning over the loss of a loved one. The visitors bring meals, take care of the house, do whatever has to be done so that the family can actually mourn and do nothing but mourn for an entire week. We did this for my aunt who was a Jewess. Very, very interesting thing. I've never experienced that. But, you know, the whole family, everybody comes and they bring some food and the food just overflows. And for a week, they don't have to worry about a thing except mourning over their loved one. Okay? And at the end of that mourning period, it's over. We start our lives again. Okay? That's the idea. In the case of Israel, they no sooner finished mourning for Miriam and moved a few miles to Mount Hor. It's on Edom's border. Not in Edom, but on Edom's border. Then they got to do it all again, this time for Aharon, their Kohen HaGadol. Yeshua's ancestor, who corresponds to Mount Hor, is Azur, which means hopeful. His name has the root Azar, 58:26, Azar, which means to succor, assistance or support in a time of distress. Sitting Shiva. Not only was succor what Israel needed right then, but I think it was Yehovah who supplied it. They were encamped at Mount Hor, the looming mountain, which foreshadowed the next event. Hor is from the unused root Harar, meaning looming or a threatening presence. So Mount Harar, looming presence, mountain of the looming presence. Yehovah sat Shiva with Israel because Hasatan was going to try to use these back-to-back losses to discourage them. Discouragement from the enemy was looming, and Yehovah sat Shiva to suffer them. The next event, which is right away, they're still at Mount Hor, was that in an attempt to kick Israel while they were down, Hasatan inspired King Herod to take some Israelites hostage. When Hasatan meant to cause Israel to despair, Yehovah used to get their Irish up. And Moshe sent a force to wipe Herod out, literally. They wiped him out and to rescue the hostages. Israel left behind nothing that drew breath and suffered not a scratch in doing so. Maybe now you know why Israel is so good at hostage rescue. They've been doing it for a millennia. As a matter of fact, they've been doing it since Abraham, because he went and rescued Lot. Remember? Okay, so the very first Ivrit started this thing, and they carried it through all the way to the mount. There are 8 moves left before we reach the plains of Moab on the east bank of the Arden. And our new beginning with Yehoshua taking command and preparing us to cross the Arden to take our inheritance. You can see a little bit of a link there to Yeshua, by the way, who carries us across. The 34th stop was Tzalmonah, which means shadiness. It's not actually from the root 6757, but 6754. Tzalmon. But it's linked to Tzalmavet, the shadow of death. Psalm 33 comes to mind. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. We had just come through the valley of the shadow of death, and Yehovah gave us victory over the first Canaanite tribe who came out against us for the purpose of building our confidence that he had our backs. Remember, they just come through. Miriam died, and then Aharon died, and then they get hit by Herod at Mount Hor, and they go and they wipe them out. Yehovah is proving to them he's got their back. Yeshua's ancestor corresponding to this stop was the Tzedok, from the root 6663, meaning righteous. Yehovah had brought us through the wilderness adventure and was bringing us to our inheritance. He had lifted us up, set us apart, and we were righteous in his sight. Stop number 35 was at Konon, which means perplexity or to be distracted. The cause of the perplexing distraction isn't revealed to us, but Moshiach's ancestor corresponding to this encampment is Joachim, or Joachim, it says in Matthew. Shortened form of Yehoyakim. Yehovah raises up. In Kadesh, Elohim raised us up. Here, Yehovah raises us up. In between, Yehovah Elohim. succored us by and in his righteousness, first by sitting Shiva with us, and then by delivering us through our first battle against the Canaanite force. I think it was those in-between succorings that kept us from long consideration of the distractions that the enemy sent our way. The 36th stop, sometimes my dentures get going. The 36th stop is at Lobot, meaning water skins, which suggests refreshment. Yeshua's corresponding ancestor is Elihud, whose name means my Elohim's grandeur, Hod, meaning exalt, an imposing figure, like Abihud, Elihud. Do you think that Yehovah was telling us that he was their shield and exceeding great reward? In Genesis chapter 15 and verse 1, he says to Abraham, after these things, Devar Yehovah came unto Abraham in a vision, saying, fear not, Abraham, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. I think it's a no-brainer myself. Everything he'd done for us was to build our confidence that as long as we live in his Torah, he is our platoon's point man. He is our flankers on both sides, and he has our rear guard. Nothing and no one can harm us, regardless their bluster to the contrary, as long as we are walking in this world.
Amen.
37th stop is Iye Ha'avarim, the heap of the ruins of those who crossed over. Interesting. This is the border of Moab, one of Lot's sons, by his incestuous, while in a drunken stupor, relations with his daughters shortly after Sodom was destroyed. Lot had crossed over Euphrates with Abraham, and Abraham had saved his butt twice. Remember, he was taken by the kings in Genesis chapter 14, by the four kings. The five kings came to Abraham, and they said, they got us, and we want to go get our stuff back. And they took Lot with them. That's what made Abraham say, great, you got 318 soldiers, trained servants. And they went after them, and these 318 servants and Abraham wiped out four kings and brought them home and all of the spoil. And when they got back to Jerusalem, Abraham gave 10% of the spoil to Melchizedek. Okay? Therefore, Levi gave tithes to Melchizedek through his father, his great-grandfather, Abraham. Okay? Interesting stuff. Okay, Lot had crossed over Euphrates. That was the one time. The second time was Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay? Yehovah appears to Abraham. He says, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah in five cities of these five kings. Okay? There's another five kings. And Abraham says, well, what if there are 50 righteous men? Well, I won't destroy every 50. How about 45? How about 40? How about 30? How about 20? How about 10? Right? He figured 10. Let's see. We got Lot and his wife. He's got two daughters. They have husbands. There's already six. There's got to be four other righteous men somewhere in the town. As a matter of fact, Lot was the only righteous person there. Tells us so in Hebrews and in 2 Peter.
You wonder where the Jews get their bargaining skills.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No kidding. Okay. Yehovah had told Moshe that Israel was to do battle with neither their brother Esau or Lot's sons, their cousins Ammon and Moab. So they skirted Edom and Moab. I think the ruins of those who crossed over may have been the ruins of a Moabite city or an Ammonite city. And now we're going to get a little closer. We see in Devarim that Moab's northern border is quite a bit further north than the Yin. Okay? And that Ammon had taken all of that land from Moab. So that Israel is about to traverse on the king's highway is not legitimately ruled by either Moab, who lost it, or Ammon, who were ruling it by way of conquest. Moshe did not ask Ammon's leave to cross his territory until he actually got to what Ammon was promised by Yehovah. Was gifted by Yehovah, and not by road of conquest. Knowing that, I think that those ruins, Iyahawarim, are a Moabite city that Ammon destroyed in taking that land. And that the place is aptly named. Yeshua's progenitor, lining up with Iyat HaAvarim, is Eleazar, whose name means Elohim succors or helps. At this time, the succor that Kol Yisrael is receiving is that they are not engaged in internal conflict, tribe against tribe, like were Moab and Ammon. Brothers were fighting brothers. Civil war. Anyway, I think that a second sowed thought may be that these last few stops correspond to the first patriarchs. This one to Abraham, as the deliverer of Lot, and the master of Eleazar, the servant of Abraham, who went to get Yitzhak, a bride. Okay? Eleazar. The 38th stop was at Divon Gad, the wasting or pining of a troop or crowd. Why this is named pining of a crowd isn't told us, but perhaps it has to do with the circumstances of the last stop, where brother fought brother to the destruction of a city. Yeshua's great-granddad was Matan, whose name derives from Natan, meaning gift or to give, Nathan. If I'm right about Israel's empathy for their cousins Moab and Ammon, they are also rejoicing over the gift of Yehovah that they were not at each other's throats, because such family squabbles are more the rule than the exception in this world. By the way, if the rest of this teaching is correct, this gift is the gift that Abraham received of Yehovah, Yitzhak. Stop number 39 is at Almon Diblaim, a concealed or sowed double cake of figs. I think we see the sowed of Yeshua's pappy and grandpappy. We might see the reason for the double cake of figs. Yeshua's supposed paternal grandfather's name is Yaakov. I have no doubt that Joseph's father's name was actually Yaakov, by the way. This is not just an allusion to Yitzhak's son, Yaakov, but I think that it is that also. Yaakov, the son of Yitzhak, had two sons who were tzaddikim, Yehuda and Yosef. Each was, in his own way, sweetness to Yaakov, as one would be the progenitor of a land of kings, and the other would be the progenitor of the land of tzaddikim. And their lines would merge in the real Melchizedek. Yeshua, the double cake of figs. The 40th stop is Avarim, before Nebo. Nebo is the highest mountain in the Avarim. The Avarim is the mountain range on the east side of Jordan. And likely Pisgah, where Moshe... Okay, Nebo is the highest mountain in the Avarim, and likely Pisgah, where Moshe was called to view the entire land of Israel, I think from the Euphrates to the Red Sea, and all at least the Nile, and there he was to die. The whole northern part of the Avarim is called Pisgah, and Nebo is the highest of these mountains. Moshiach Yeshua's progenitor, corresponding to this stop, is Yosef, the husband of Miriam, who I believe corresponds to the plains of Moab and Transjordan. Nebo, Pisgah, being the highest of this range of mountains, relates very easily to Yosef, the son of Yaakov, who was arguably the most tzaddik of the tzaddikim of the Tanakh. Yosef, Miriam's husband, meanwhile, is declared a righteous man as well, a tzaddik, in Matthew chapter 1, starting in verse 18. Now the birth of Mashiach Yeshua was on this wise: when as his mother Miriam was espoused to Yosef, before they came together, she was found with child with Ruach HaKodesh. Then Yosef, her husband, being a just man is added, okay, in italics, being just at tzaddik, and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on those things, behold, the angel Yehovah appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Yosef, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Miriam thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of Ruach HaKodesh. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Yehoshua, that is Yeshua for short. For he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of Jehovah by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is Elohim with us. And Yosef, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of Yehovah had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not until she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Yehoshua. And Yeshua came as Moshiach ben Yosef, rather, in his incarnation, to call the lost sheep of the house of Israel out of their exile. My people, in Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 6, my people have been a lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. They have turned them away from the mountains. They have gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. Their shepherds, their pastors, their rabbis, their kings, their priests were leading them astray. Okay? Very similar to what's going on today. Matthew 10, verse 6. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And Matthew 15, 24. But he answered Yeshua and said to them, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. When he returns, he will come as Moshiach ben David, to bring the two sticks together and to be one king over both houses, and will call scattered Israel, both Yehudah and Ephraim, and by the way, all of the whosoever wills who want to go with him, from the four corners of the earth. The 41st stop was at the plains of Moab on the foot of the Abarim. It was here that Balak sent for Balaam to curse Israel for him. It was here that Balaam blessed Israel after seeing the order of the camp. It was here that Balak followed Balaam's advice and sent daughters of Moab to entice Israel to adultery and idolatry. This worked against some of the general population, but not for the elders or the priests. So Balak sent the daughters of the elders of Midian to entice the princes of Israel, and Zimri, prince of Simeon, took Cozbi, princess of Midian, to the Mishkan before Moshe and all the people, and into the Mishkan itself. It says in the King James Version, they went into the tent, where Pinchas stayed Jehovah's wrath by pinning them both to the floor of the tent with one stroke from the spear. So they must have been lying on the floor, one on top of the other. Kalimbo. This was where the last 24,000 Israelites died before entering the land, by the plague that Jehovah sent as a result of succumbing to the doctrine of Balaam. Israel was finally purged of the entire generation who had chosen the word of the tourists over the word of Jehovah. You might think that we're out of Yeshua's progenitors because we've gotten to the last name in the genealogy. Okay? But if you'll notice, there were only 12 patriarchs between Shealtiel and Yeshua. Only 12. So, who's the 13th ancestor of Yehoshua in Matthew chapter 1? How about Miriam, his mother? Okay? When she was found with child, everyone who knew it figured that she'd been unfaithful to her espoused husband, Joseph. Even Joseph, remember, in much the same way that Israel had played the whore at Baal Peor. Jehovah told Yosef to marry her as he would do with Israel, and that the son born to her would be Moshiach. Yosef was a tzaddik. He obeyed without even thinking. He bore the reproach of adultery. For what could people think when he didn't put away his adulterous intended, and actually married her? In their eyes, this must be his own son. There is controversy over whose genealogy it is in Matthew, whether it's Joseph's or Miriam's. I think it's Joseph's, but I don't think it makes a lot of difference if it is Miriam's. The Aramaic clearly says Gaul, guardian. And I get this from the Restoration Scriptures. But that could also refer to her husband, as it says in the ADNT in their names. It could be, as the Restoration Scriptures note says, that Yosef in verse 16 is her guardian, and Yosef in verse 19 is her husband, two different men. But I don't think so. I don't see why her guardian might not become her husband as well. If he was both, think about this for a minute. Imagine the scandal of an older guardian seemingly impregnating a ward in his care, and the despite that he might receive from his neighbors, and the names that they might call him. Yehoshua. Mamzer would be collected. But Miriam was not an adulterous woman. She was the chosen vessel of Yehovah to bring forth from her flesh, made from the dust of the earth, Moshiach. Yehovah brought forth the bread of life from an earthen vessel, Miriam. Chamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. And they called his name Yehoshua. There's only one stop to go. Stop number 42 is on the other side, on Israel's side of the Arden. And we don't get there in Numbers chapter 33. This would be done in the first month in time for the first recorded Pesach in 40 years. And who would lead them to cross over the Arden but Yehoshua, Moshe's servant, Joshua, the shadow of Moshiach Yeshua, who will lead us into the kingdom and then to the new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Catch the connections? Okay. You want to write to me by any chance? That's P.O. Box 500, PNB 203, Junaid Hutton, Ohio. That's snail mail. And that's my email address, mark@thetrump.net. You want to contact me? That's how I do it. Okay? That's all I got. A little after that. You all kept quiet so I could get through it by 9 o'clock, didn't you?
Quick question.
Quick question.
Whereabouts do you think the Korah incident happened?
Probably in Kadesh. Probably. I mean, there isn't any mention of them moving and all that time. I really think that, think about what the camp looked like. And I can see how Korah would be probably as close as he can get to the Mishkan. He was the leader of his tribe. Therefore, he was in camp, like, from here to there, from the Levites. Okay? And then from there, it's only a few more 800 yards to the Mishkan. Maybe 100 yards. So, I could see how that would work. And Dathan was probably the camp in the same camp. I'm sure that was you, the room. That's what I think. I could be wrong.
That would be the brother versus brother incident that might make them very happy that they weren't doing it anymore.
That could very well be. Yeah, because that was a bad one. That caused all kinds of trouble in the camp. Anything else?
You noticed about to blame the two big kids. Did you ever notice that Hoshea's father is to blame?
Sorry?
Prophet Hoshea, his father is to blame.
Ah.
Two big kings.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And everything about Hoshea is the reunification.
Reunification of Yehuda and then the triumph. Yeah. Good point. Good point. Well, I'm done.
Okay, we have many people here, but not all people here yet. We still have a host of freelanders and more residents. You interrupt me. Not stupid. Okay, so tomorrow morning, just so everybody knows, the building will be left unlocked. It's something we worked out with the team and with the guy who's now running the camp. So I can take care of that for you, Mark. So this back door will remain unlocked, the white door. So you have access to the bathrooms. The kitchen door will be closed but remain unlocked. And this door leading into this major area will be closed but unlocked. The front doors, however, will be locked. The external ones are broken, so you can get to them anytime. The internal ones have a hole, and that will be bolted. Unless Rebecca is staying up. Okay, then last person out, I need you to ensure, unless you're going to stay here all the way through the morning, I need you to ensure you turn off the lights. Those light switches over there operate all these lights up here. There are two light switches on the other side of the faux brick. over there that take care of the lights over in the living area. Please make sure that you close those doors. Please make sure you close those doors. Do not lock those doors. And please make sure that you have all the lights out, and especially the kitchen light, because there's a fan tied to it that makes that thing that you're running. That would not be cool. When you come in tomorrow morning, there will be milk in the refrigerator in the kitchen. Other than that, you need to bring your stuff. There's Gene cleaning up right now. You can hear her vacuum cleaner. She comes in every night at 9 o'clock to shut everything down except that we're here, so she and I can be doing that while we're here. We're going to do some different organization of things for our evening meal tomorrow and such, so that we're a little better prepared. We will be serving food processing.